Georgia is set to purge over 300,000 names from its voter rolls, in a move that advocates worry could primarily target people of color and younger voters. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for November 4th, look at how Georgia fits into the nationwide battle over voting rights heading into 2020, and why the demise of Deadspin could be an alarming sign of things to come in the digital media industry.
It was about control. It was about who got to set the mission of this organization. And of course, they bought the thing. They get to run it. However, they never showed any interest in learning what it was about.
We start with voting rights in Georgia right now. Last week, state officials in Georgia announced plans to remove more than 300,000 names from its voter rolls. Election officials say this targets voters who have been inactive or who have moved out of the state in the last few years. But voting rights advocates are worried the purge will disproportionately suppress people of color and younger voters. And with close attention being paid to voting rights in the lead up to 2020, the Georgia purge is just the latest example of how contentious voter registration is becoming. Joining me now to talk about Georgia and the impact of voter purges on people of color is Carol Anderson, a professor at the Department of African American Studies at Emory University and the author of White Rage. Carol, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Tanzina.
I'm also joined by Nancy Thomas, the director at the Tufts Institute for Democracy and Higher Education, to talk about how young people, in particular college students, are targeted by these purges. Nancy, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Carol, let's start with you. If Georgia cuts 300,000 voters, that would essentially mean they lose 4% of the state's eligible voters. How are election officials in Georgia justifying this?
Well, they justify it by saying that all they're doing is what federal law requires, which is maintaining the voter rolls. They are looking at people who haven't voted in several years, people who may have died or have moved out of the voting district. And so it sounds really routine and like regular maintenance. I mean, because everybody believes you ought to keep your voter rolls maintained. But voter suppression is always cloaked in reasonableness. So that's why you've got the skepticism coming through, because Georgia has a history of targeting minority voters.
So let's talk about that, because you're really focusing here on how this would target voters of color. Why do you say that there would be a disproportionate impact on that community?
One of the key elements here is that when they say that they're looking at people who haven't voted regularly, what we know from the research is that people who are minorities, people who are young, people who are college students, those are the groups that don't vote regularly. And so when you use not regular voting as the litmus test for whether you get removed from the rolls, you get disproportionately removals for those groups.
And why is it that certain voters may have been seen as inactive? Or is it also a question of voter suppression ID or the lack of having the correct identification to go to the polls? Are all these things sort of playing into each other?
They really do play into each other. Since 2014, this is after the Shelby County v. Holder decision gutted the Voting Rights Act, the state of Georgia has shut down over 200 polling places. 75% of those have been in minority and poor communities. What we know, again from the research, is that for every tenth of a mile that a polling place is moved, Black voter turnout goes down by 0.5%. So if you have moved a polling place, which has then made it doubly difficult for people to be able to get to the polls because of the lack of transportation, then they haven't voted because you have removed the polling place where they used to vote. So the state sets up a barrier and then uses that barrier that the state has erected as then the justification to remove you.
Nancy, let's talk about another group of folks who might be disproportionately affected by this, the younger voting population. We've seen younger people turning out more. In 2018, there was a huge turnout. Why are they showing up in purge lists like the one in Georgia, if they are, in fact, turning out to the polls?
Well, first of all, young people are turning out to the polls in higher numbers, particularly 2018, which was a pretty exciting year for this age and demographic group. And the reason why purging affects young people is because they move and they're not settled the way some older people might be. So if you move and change your address, then you're not going to receive that direct mailing that says, we are purging you from the voter rolls. Bear in mind, too, that with younger people, they don't communicate that way. They communicate with their thumbs. And so it's not an effective way to communicate with them by using direct mail. Also, just to point out a few things about Georgia, there are 540,000 college and university students in Georgia, and nearly 30% of those are older than 24 years old. So if they're going to purge records, say, after 5 years or based on non-voting, then what they're going to do is they're going to hit a lot of college students who enter school and, contrary to the mythology about college students, probably don't graduate within 4 years. They graduate within 6 years. And so that means at some point during their tenure at college, they may have to re-register. That is not only inconvenient, it's not particularly rational, frankly, and it's unnecessary.
What about this idea, Nancy, that most people would say, of course, we want to make sure the voter rolls are maintained. But what about this idea that people have to be taken off within, 5 years if they haven't voted? I mean, doesn't that go against the fact that you've already signed up, you chose to vote 1 year, you didn't choose? Is that punitive against people who choose not to vote?
I am certain that it has discriminatory purposes behind it because of the groups that it targets and the groups that it disproportionately affects. But more to the point, it's unnecessary. There is no strong evidence of voter fraud or people voting twice or moving and voting where they used to live and where they now live. We have enough trouble getting Americans to vote generally. So there's no reason behind it. Yes, of course we want tidy voter rolls. That would be ideal. But until we have better systems that are not so convoluted and full of misinformation, and we have more supportive local officials who are willing to work with different groups and ensure that they are able to vote, I think this has a discriminatory intent.
And Nancy, is there a concern here that younger voters are perhaps partisan voters? I mean, it's hard to determine the intent here, but I'm just wondering if there's something to that. When we talk about voter suppression, it's often an indirect, as Carol was saying, towards communities of color. Could that be the same thing towards younger voters, that they perhaps tend to vote more liberal or progressive party lines?
I think that is the unspoken and, frankly, in a few cases, very spoken motivation behind this. But it's such a misguided approach to take. So that's like saying, I don't want to allow you to vote because you might vote against me. And that means that our public officials are choosing their voters, as opposed to the way it should be, which is our voters choose our public officials. So would this necessarily be a partisan vote? Right now, young people overwhelmingly vote more progressive and lean Democrat. But that doesn't mean that the Republicans can't change their platforms to appeal to this age group and this demographic group of voters. There is nothing stopping them from designing a platform that will interest young people. So I am a little distressed when I hear, well, we want to stop college students or young people or people of color from voting because we don't think they're going to vote for us.
Carol, you said early at the top of the segment that this is something that in Georgia in particular has played out in the past. And I'm thinking the very recent past. I mean, just in 2018, if you could remind our listeners about the lawsuit between Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp and how that played out in Georgia.
Yeah. So in that, what we had in that election was we had Brian Kemp as the Secretary of State running for governor and refusing to step down as Secretary of State. So he basically ran the election in which he was running. And as he ran that election, what we had the year before the election, 10% of Georgia's voter rolls had been purged by him. We had that in October, after the purging could no longer happen legally, we had then what was called exact match. And what Exact Match did was it looked at voter registration cards, matched it up with the state databases or with the Social Security Administration. And if there was any difference between what was on the voter registration and what was in the state database, then that voter registration was put into electoral limbo. It was kicked out of the system for all intents and purposes. Exact Match. So if you had a hyphen in your name, Garcia Marquez, but that hyphen didn't show up in the state database, then you were kicked out. 53,000 voter registrations were held up in October of 2018. 70% of those were African American.
Carol, why? And when we talk about these issues, we often have to prove disparate impact here. That to me sounds like a pretty glaring disparate impact on Black voters in particular. Why is this issue, in your opinion, not gotten the national attention, at least that it should be getting, given that we are 1 year away from a very significant presidential election? I haven't heard much about this issue coming up even in the Democratic debates so far.
Exactly. I have just been frustrated about the lack of understanding what voter suppression has done. And I think it's because it is so wonderfully, beautifully bureaucratic that it sounds reasonable. We must maintain voter rolls. We have to ensure that the people who say they are who they are the ones voting. We have to have election integrity. So it's wrapped and swaddled in all of the language of protection of democracy. And to try to unpack it in sound bites, because too often we are reduced to sound bites. Voter fraud, right? Voter fraud catches on, although voter fraud does not happen at the level that this apparatus for disfranchising millions of citizens has created. And so the Brennan Center, for instance, found that between 2014 and 2018, 33 million Americans had been purged off of the voter rolls. If we saw the kind of violence that we saw during the civil rights movement and saw 33 million bodies piled up there, then we would be shocked and horrified as a nation. But because this is like a silent civic death, we don't see it, and we don't have the kind of visibility that is necessary to bring this to the fore to show how our democracy is really being eviscerated. It was like how Nancy said, there are politicians who are targeting young people and targeting minorities because they say they won't vote for us. And we see that when we see that as you're having polling stations moved off of college campuses, as you're seeing the kind of putting a dividing line, a gerrymandered line between right there on a college campus. So one district is one part of the college is on one part of the district and another piece of the college is in another congressional district. All of those things are designed to target. And that's what we're seeing. But it's so subtle that it doesn't get the kind of attention that it rightly deserves.
Carol Anderson is a professor at the Department of African American Studies at Emory University, author of White Rage, and Nancy Thomas is the director of the Tufts Institute for Democracy and Higher Education. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. In an already dramatic year for journalism, every writer and editor at the sports and culture site Deadspin parted ways with the company last week, following an editorial mandate from private equity firm and new owners Great Hill Partners. A staff memo demanded Deadspin employees, quote, stick to sports and stay away from everything else. This was despite the fact that internal numbers suggested these non-sports stories consistently generated more readership. The decision created a ripple effect within Deadspin, leading the entire staff to either be fired or resign in protest. And that makes Deadspin just the latest example of what can happen when private equity companies that often have no experience in news or media mix with journalism. Joining us now are Max Tawney, a media reporter at The Daily Beast, and Megan Greenwell, the editor of Wired.com and the former editor-in-chief of Deadspin. Max, Megan, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Megan, let's start with you. You left Deadspin in August, a little before the memo was sent out. What was it that prompted you to leave?
It was many of the same forces. I was getting pressure to stop covering things that we had been covering. And I was also just being systemically undermined and lied to by my bosses. Our editorial director of Geo Media had told me that he would send out an email guaranteeing editorial independence for the newsroom after the CEO sent an email just like calling my credibility into question and that of a young reporter I edited. It got really crazy, and it became clear that the only hope for the site to stay alive was for me to leave so they could take the win of having me out. Of course, it didn't work out that way, but it is a pretty clear straight line from what drove me out to what happened last week.
Well, let's talk about what happened last week, because it went from this memo that was released to staff just leaving en masse. Like, tell us about that.
So the memo came out on Monday, and it was not different from what we had been told by the editorial director, Paul Maidment, but seeing it written really crystallized it for everybody. And so Barry Pachesky, who was my deputy and who then became the interim editor-in-chief of the site and who has been there for a decade, he is the heart and soul of that site. He said, we're not going to change what we do based on this memo. We know what we do is successful. And so what we are going to do is we're going to publish a bunch of non-sports stuff. And so that's what they did on Tuesday morning. And I think, you know, on some level, Barry knew he was putting his job on the line, but he's also a deeply ethical leader. And he knew that he couldn't just bow to this, which was not what readers wanted, which was not the site that he had really helped create. And so he did it, and he was called in and was fired on Tuesday.
I want to get a little bit into the back and forth between the what we call often the business side versus the editorial side in a minute. But Max, you broke the story last week about this internal memo that told Deadspin staff to stick with sports. What was that like? I mean, why was management mandating the stick to sports rule in your reporting? What did you find?
You know, that's a really good question. And that's something that I've been kind of thinking about a lot, too, over the past few days, because they obviously knew that this was something that was a point of contention, because in the memo they said, you know, we don't know if we've been clear about this or not. It's really kind of, I think, a mix of several factors. It was clear that that several of the top people who are at the company were not necessarily on board with the tone always on the site. And when Geo Media was formed earlier this year, once they kind of took over the company from Univision, which was the previous owner, one of the things that was mentioned is they wanted to be able to, you know, increase the sales of ads and kind of more specifically increase the sale of kind of like some, make it a little bit more somewhat family friendly. That was kind of something that I went back over when I was thinking about why this was the case. And so I think that they just wanted to make the site more palatable to advertisers who might be uncomfortable with some stuff on the site. And then I think that they also thought that they might be able to say, well, this is a sports site. So they might be able to tell advertisers, this is a sports site. This is the only kind of content that you'll see your ads next to. And, you know, I think that they wanted maybe less variability in what the types of content kind of were.
My only pushback to that is Deadspin historically has always been profitable. And a former ad sales rep for the company tweeted last week that Deadspin was always an incredibly easy site to sell ads on because advertisers wanted to be next to that lifestyle content and culture content. So I certainly think that is something that's going through their brains. I also just think it's factually wrong.
And let's say, because you Megan, you wrote a piece called Adults in the Room that sort of spoke to and really pushed back on this notion that the non-sport stories weren't doing as well as the stick to sports stories. Tell us about that.
Right. So we got internal numbers that were shared around the company in August and have now been shared with multiple media reporters that showed that about 2% of our content was non-sports stuff. And those articles, on average, performed roughly twice as well, you know, on a page view level as the sports stuff did. So it was not as if, you know, Paul Maidment said something last week about how I was trying to push it in a less sports direction. That was never true. I have vision memos after vision memos that I tried to present to them showing why this was important, showing the data, et cetera. It's not as if we were trying to eliminate the sports content, but they just could not listen to the idea that A, this is popular, the readers want it, B, it's really critical to what the voice of the site is, and this was really the big problem. I think the stick to sports thing is almost a little bit of a red herring because it was about control. It was about who got to set the mission of this organization. And of course, they bought the thing. They get to run it. However, they never showed any interest in learning what it was about. They had very clearly never read Deadspin before they came in, and they had no interest in what it was, what had made it popular, what had made it successful.
And to that point, Max, I mean, let's talk a little bit about more broadly in media. I think we are all media people, and so we all know how the media works, right? But generally speaking, in our fantasy lives, in our fantasy brains, there is a business side to media, the people that sell the ads. And then there is the editorial side, right? The people who write the content and create the content. Now, in theory, those two sides are supposed to be completely separate, like a church and state thing. Max, you cover the media. Are you seeing less and less of that? Are you seeing more influence from the business side, the advertising side, on the folks that are supposed to just be independent and write the stuff?
You know, I think that you might, while it might not be conscious, I think that because media is in such a state of turmoil and tumult, particularly the digital media space over the past several years, I think that it is inevitable that some of those pressures are going to bleed over onto editorial. So while you might not see something like what happened in this case, which I think is really, really stark in terms of, you know, an order from the top saying editorial cannot do this thing.
And just so we're clear, the order from the top did not come from the top editor. It came from the business folks, right?
Right, it did. Mm-hmm. Who, by the way, just for what it's worth, in my reporting earlier this year, you know, we pointed out that the CEO, Jim Svamfeller, who was also an investor in the company, you know, had on occasion suggested to editors in chief of sites, oh, well, why don't you bring some business people along with your with edit folks? And obviously, editors were very, very quick to say, no, we're not going to do that, and kind of moved on. But this is clearly something that was on his mind. How do we bring, you know, our ad and business side kind of over into editorial? And so I think that it's inevitable that, you know, some of the market pressures are going to, you know, put pressure on editorial staff in ways that maybe they haven't experienced before.
Megan, your thoughts on that? And more specifically, when I think about Deadspin, I think about, you know, its genesis, really, with the whole, it was part of a broader suite of websites that included Gawker and other sites that were really popular just a couple of years ago. And suddenly, for those who don't remember, the Gawker-Peter Thiel lawsuit, right, in which Gawker no longer exists. Do you think that those pressures from the business side, and we'll talk more about specifically about private equity in a minute, but the pressures from the business side or the fear of being sued by someone like a Peter Thiel is what's weighing here in Deadspin and maybe even more broadly?
Sure. I would separate those two things out a little bit. There are certainly ad pressures. There are the pressures to get enough clicks, et cetera. There are also incredibly vindictive billionaires out there who are creating serious threats to freedom of the press. And I think any of these stories that have been covering the death of Deadspin that don't mention Peter Thiel and how that directly led to this, I mean, that bankrupted Gawker Media, pushed Nick Denton, who, for all of his eccentricities, was a great media owner in terms of letting people do what they did to make the company successful. And so I think there are a couple of things going on here. I don't disagree that those advertiser pressures are real and very present. But I do think, like, there's a larger freedom of the press issue here that people are loath to admit when discussing sites like Gawker, but could just as easily come for something that, you know, people consider more legit or more mainstream or whatever.
Max, let's focus a little bit here on the private equity lens. This is not new, what's happening with private equity companies buying media companies. I wrote about this at the New York Times almost a decade ago, right? When private equity companies seem to be really interested in this thing called newspapers. Tell us about why. What's prompting these companies to want to buy media companies?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to point out that one of the biggest reasons why private equity are the only kind of some of the biggest players in this space is because they're some of the only people who are left who are interested in media companies. I think that what we've seen over the past few years in terms of media ownership and in terms of major media moves are kind of several things. One, you've seen kind of these mergers of classic media companies. Fox and New York Magazine just announced a merger several months ago. You see takeovers by private equity firms, which is what we've seen in terms of, you know, some of the major newspapers that you mentioned, like Gannett, which owns USA Today and a lot of major papers. And then you also see, you know, kind of your takeovers by, large, the uber super rich. And the reality is that those are three of the only major people who are left willing to play in the digital and traditional media space outside of television, obviously, just because they've seen, I think that they've seen the implosion of the advertising revenue model. And they don't want to put as much they don't want to get involved in as much risk. And I think private equity firms are more willing to take on a lot of these media companies and say, okay, the way that we're going to kind of flip them, make them profitable and sell them to somebody else is by slashing costs big time, which means selling off some of these brands, which is what we've seen Geo Media is exploring with Clickhole, the internet site that they also own that was reported by the Wall Street Journal this week. And what we've seen with Gannett, which is also, you know, thought about selling off and has in many cases sold off and otherwise, cut several publications and thought about cutting jobs. So I think that in reality, private equity owners in this case are more willing, I think, to make some of these bolder, bigger moves that a lot of, more traditional media owners kind of shied away from out of nostalgia or commitment to the mission and things of kind of that nature.
Megan, want to get your thoughts on this, too, because I'm wondering if there are places where you're seeing either private equity or just like the people like billionaires, if you will, or gazillionaires who are investing in media where there's some good spots. And I'm going to give some examples where I think I'd be curious to know your thoughts. There's Lauren Powell Jobs, right? One of the richest women in the world who started up the pseudo venture capital fund, Emerson Collective. Jeff Bezos at The Washington Post, lots of, you know, thoughts on that. Craig Newmark now has his name on my former journalism school and has also been investing significantly in digital media in particular. Your thoughts on, are these positive signs for the journalism industry?
I think what's positive about that is all three of those examples seem to have some sort of like philanthropic component to them. Lauren Powell Jobs has bought The Atlantic and California Sunday, which I'm assuming are not like tremendous margin businesses, right? Craig Newmark invested to create The Markup, which is sort of a tech accountability site that doesn't even quite exist yet. Jeff Bezos doesn't seem to care a tremendous amount about how much of a profit The Washington Post is turning. And so it is good to see people that consider journalism sort of mission-driven. I still think it's terrifying to have individual billionaires controlling media. Jeff Bezos could decide tomorrow, you know what, I'm done. Like, this is a drain on my resources. There haven't been indications that he will, but he certainly could. And he could leave the Washington Post, you know, send it back to the Stone Ages, essentially. So yeah, it's hard to say.
Which is different than, I think, what we've seen with the Washington Post prior, which was owned by a family, with the New York Times, which is still partly owned by the Sulzberger family. So there were these sort of media dynasties, if you will, that really were, at least in theory, had a mission, some sort of moral mission to continue what the organization was doing. This is happening also a lot in digital media outside of the Washington Post and all these other places. These were a lot of digital sites that were built from the ground up digital, you know, and the big promise a decade ago, Max, was that these were the sites that were going to take over the world. And now we're slowly seeing that they, too, are struggling. Your thoughts on where they go from here with what happened to Deadspin just this week or last week?
You know, that's a really good question. And I think it's, again, it's important to separate out. I think in a lot of instances, a few years ago, there was kind of a lot of venture capital, and in the digital media space. And I think in some cases you saw that that was successful. I think Gawker Media, the former company, was actually profitable and was valued at, you know, something over north of $150 million before the Thiel lawsuit. So I think it's important to point out that, you know, while there's a lot of instances like Mike.com and some other digital media websites that kind of imploded because of poor management and, you know, Facebook changing its mind about whether or not it wanted to prioritize news, I think there are some particular bright spots, and there are lessons to be learned from sites like, you know, Gawker Media, Gizmodo Media, and now, you know, some of the sites that still remain at Geo Media, where, you know, if there's a commitment to audience and your readers really, really love the kind of content that you're producing, you know, there are actually still a lot of ways that you can make money beyond the kind of programmatic ads that you know, the kind of ad campaigns that I think kind of tripped up, that kind of got mixed up in this whole kind of mess here. There's, you know, there's sponsorships, there's events, there's, you know, all kinds of other ways that you can kind of, that companies can kind of make money. And so I think that there are still a lot of people who believe that digital media can be a profitable business to be in. I just think that, you know, there are clear ways in which, you know, there are clear pitfalls that management, you know, can, and other companies can avoid when treating editorial and understanding how to work with journalists to make it kind of case where there's buy-in on the editorial side as well.
Megan, let's bring it back to the journalists here. We started talking about the folks that left, and I guess one of the questions I have is, what happens to them? You know, we saw the gutting of local news around the country, which continues, the small newspapers, the smaller television stations where young journalists in particular would get their start. Digital media at least seemed to try to fill some of that vacuum with a balance, with a mix of new, you know, young journalists and more seasoned journalists. When you have these things that are happening, as Max mentioned, Mike in particular, what happens to the journalist? I mean, where do they go? Do they continue to stay in the industry? Is this point? I mean, you've landed quite well, but I'm sure some folks who are leaving or have left Deadspin maybe will leave the industry.
Yeah, it's really tough because on one hand, there are no jobs, really. And on the other hand, everybody's so demoralized by all of this stuff. You know, this is the second publication I've worked for that has, you know, folded completely or something akin to it. And it just sort of breaks your spirit. And I worked with so many wildly talented people at Deadspin who are in their 20s, who are in their 30s. They have so much career left. And they are just brilliantly talented. But it is sort of like, where are the jobs going to come from? And are they going to end up in this same situation again? We've been talking about this in our like staff group chat a lot over the last week. You know, how do we avoid this happening again? Because no matter what company you go to, private equity could buy it up next week. And so they're all wonderful and they should all get all of the jobs they want. You know, I think plenty of people have said Deadspin should start its own thing. The problem with that is everybody is suggesting, you know, oh, I'd throw in $50 on Kickstarter. That's not enough to pay people's salaries and health insurance. So if billionaires are listening who consider journalism a mission-minded organization, they should definitely reach out. But, you know, in the absence of that, I think a lot of people will spread and will make other journalistic outlets much, much better. And I think we're going to continue to see the contraction and young, talented people fleeing the industry for one reason or another. And it's really sad. And it's a crisis that needs to be stopped.
Well, you all heard it here first. Spend your money on journalism. Megan Greenwell is the editor of Wired.com. Max Tawney is a media reporter at The Daily Beast. Thanks to you both so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And just a programming note, The Takeaway did reach out to Geo Media for comment on this story, but we have not received a response. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.